woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
Tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. We have Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures up 25. NASDAQ futures up 107. So we're piling on yesterday's rally, at least so far. Yesterday's rally was quite the rally. We flipped from... the downside, I mean, when you talk about these flips, and I know I do this every day because because I have incredible difficulty. A guy like Greg or guys like Lou, to cover all this scratch, they can understand these numbers much better than me. But when you talk about a company like NVIDIA trading just about touched 100 on Tuesday night after Microsoft's earnings were lousy, or the AI earnings were lousy, and now it's trading 120. Well, they got 24 billion shares outstanding. That's $500 billion in market cap flipped in a day without anybody. Morgan Stanley loves them. Kramer loves them. And all of a sudden, it's not that a stock can't go up or down. I mean, that's the market. That's what we all love and try and profit by. But I think once in a while, somebody has to take a look and say...
You know, Microsoft did that, too, overnight other day.
They were $32 down. They have a...
whatever what do they have got threatened.
What do they have outstanding? I will look. Do we have Professor Lou?
Good morning. How are you all?
I'm doing fine, except, I don't know, sometimes I read more than I should, Lou. I saw yesterday or the day before that William Calley died. And I remember that as being a really awful chapter, and I've been reading here about him all morning, and it's really an awful chapter. I mean, what an amazing thing, huh?
Yeah, well, so Callie's case was one of those sort of, you know, key turning points in how we viewed ourselves in the overall context of Vietnam and the combat there. And I will tell you, as you know, somebody who went through the law of war training and law of armed combat training. That's what they used to call it, LOAC, law of armed conflict. It's now called operational law or, you know, whatever. Anyway, I went through the training following the Cali debacle and everything that was associated with it. And it did cause a real shift in U.S. Armed Forces training and viewpoint with respect to how you dealt with the kinds of situations that Cali and his people were confronting. I mean, what you saw, and I think it's fairly well defined now, but what you saw was an explosion of anger and frustration by those Americans in an absolutely brutal, awful way. And what we also, you know, have to remember is that this was provoked. This is exactly what the Viet Cong wanted to happen, because their tactics were aimed at producing this kind of a result. And you know, we ignore the stressors and the impact on people in sustained combat against an enemy using civilians as cover and as combatants themselves. We ignore the stressors on guys that are put in that situation at our peril, and this was one of the big lessons coming out of My Lai. you know, that and the you know, the real unwillingness of the Army, and they're not unusual in this, they just happen to be a public organization, the real unwillingness of the Army to confront what happened, try to cover it up, and really not do anything to the people involved until Seymour Hersh blew that story up.
Yeah, for anybody who doesn't, there's a place called My Lai, actually were a couple of villages, but
Sung Mi, My Lai were the two that I recall.
And the people came in there, but his Cali had kind of a weird history to him anyway, didn't he? He had some big fight with Marines a little bit before and everything, and
I think the general assessment was he was not well trained and not, you know, not a sterling guy, but you know, that's whatever his personality quirks are no excuse for what happened, and as I said, the cover up is almost, although it's not, I don't think that's possible, but the cover up from a sort of an institutional perspective was worse than the actual event. I mean, you can look at something like this and say, okay, we had guys go crazy, you know, it happens in combat. We see this happen occasionally. It happened throughout World War II. It happened in Korea, and it happened in Vietnam in circumstances not quite as awful, but similar to what happened in My Lai. But you can write that down as you know, one-offs, whatever. The cover-up reflected a kind of institutional and bureaucratic rot within the Army, and you know, to my mind, that was much more impactful, if I can use that word, than the actual crime. I mean, I will relate a story to you that.
Well, let me just give you the seriousness of what we're talking about. The total debt is 504 people from 247 families. 24 families lost everyone, 3 generations, no survivors. Included in the 504 were 60 elderly men, 282 women, 17 of whom were pregnant, 123 children, 53 of which were infants. This is serious stuff. This is not just a couple of people.
They went berserk, Tom.
Yeah, it's
let me give you.
Yeah, go ahead. Keep going.
This is one of those chilling memories I have from my childhood. My parents, when we lived in Canada, were good friends with a couple who were older, slightly older. The guy was maybe 10 years older than my father. So he had fought in World War II. He one night, you know, they were talking about, my father was talking about, you know, the kind of brutality that you know, we were seeing in Indochina, because that's how Vietnam was referred to in the early 60s.
Oh yeah.
And this guy said, you know, I could, you know, tell you something I haven't told anybody else, and it happened when we were in Italy, and the upshot of it was that his guys, he was a commander of a Canadian company with about 100 and some odd people who had moved into an Italian town, and they were coming in behind the frontline troops, but they had been in the front lines for like 2 weeks, and the Italy campaign was just brutal. I mean, just
was that even necessary, Luke? At the end of the day, what did the current guys think of that?
At the time, we thought it was, but you know, it was just a meat grinder, and so they had been hard fighting for 2 weeks. They were taken off the line, moving in behind another unit, and they had liberated a small Italian town and broken into a wine store, and a couple of some of the guys got drunk. One of the people in his unit had assaulted a young Italian woman, some 15-year-old or something, who either worked at this store or was around it. Anyway, this guy tried to grab her, and her father knifed him and stabbed him and killed him. And the Canadian unit rounded up every man they could find in this village, lined them up against the wall, and executed them. They put their officers under gunpoint, held their officers at gunpoint, you know, basically a mutiny, and then rounded up these guys, and you know, my father's just you know, just gone, goes white and says, how many? And this Canadian, former Canadian officer said, you know, somewhere between 50 and 100.
Well,
and just executed all of them. You know, I mean, lined them up and shot them like the Nazis did. And this kind of thing was not, I won't say it was common, but this is the kind of psychology that takes over once you get into a position where you've had friends killed and you've lost people, and it's the result of a particular population, and your units, the units go crazy. They turn on them, that's the result.
Well, it's like fighting somebody on their home turf. Well, I mean, I'm sure the British felt the same way about us.
I'm sure that was the case. But one of the things that happened as a result of My Lai was our law of armed conflict training got very specific about following illegal orders, because that was the you know, one of the things that jumped out of this was that Callie and maybe some other officers had ordered their troops to do this, you know, to just destroy the villages and kill everybody. And the circumstances were such that they had lost a bunch of people to booby traps that had been obviously laid by non-combatants or people that they thought were non-combatants behind them. They had the Viet Cong were using children in what were effectively suicide attacks. You know, they'd give a kid a grenade and tell him to go put it, walk up to the American troops there and drop it in the middle of them. They were taking rifle and machine gun fire from villages that they knew there were no Viet Cong in there. You know, and so they just said, all right, we're just gonna destroy the village and you know, send the message. But one of the things that came out of this was a very focused law of armed combat training about illegal orders and how to deal with it. If you're given an illegal order and what your legal obligations are, and then obviously this was more of a focus on legal orders, because this clearly was not, you know, it wasn't like you needed training to say don't shoot women and children. You know, everybody knew that was a violation. The thing to do and what they were trying to do was very much, by the way, what we try to do in situations involving harassment in the workplace. You try to instill in your people at the lowest level a recognition of the conduct and establish a mechanism by which you can challenge the conduct. So, for example, one of the things that I distinctly remember from the training was a scenario that plays out where an officer gives what is clearly an illegal order, you know, destroy this hospital to a subordinate. And one of the techniques was the subordinate says, all right, I want to make absolutely sure what you're asking me to do. You want me to destroy a protected target, all the way to, you know, blow the place up, burn it to the ground, and kill everybody in there. That's what you're ordering me to do. And the goal of that kind of response is to cause the person who's issuing the order to realize, you know, give them a chance to realize exactly the implications of what they've asked you to do or what they've ordered you to do. That's one of those lessons, and I remember when the trainer, we walked through the scenario with this trainer, you know, we're all 19, 20-year-old kids, and we're starting to realize the implications of, you know, being service members and what war looks like on the ground. And the officer doing the training, you know, said, you, when this happens, or if this ever happens to you, you know, try this technique. This was not used with Callie, but this was the outgrowth or one of the outgrowths of the Callie situation. Sorry for the monologue.
No, I mean, I do want to ask you this one legal question here. When you, in the midst of your monologue, please include this. Well, it says here the Fourth Geneva Convention excluded Allied civilians from the status of protected persons. So because of what you're saying, everybody was sort of involved as the citizens to some extent. In a national armed conflict, Callie and his fellow soldiers could not be legally tried as war criminals. They were instead charged with sixth specification of premeditated murder, under Article 18 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, you can't, you under the way we defined the law of armed conflict at the time, using that Geneva Convention, shooting your own people is not a, and these were allied, so these were Vietnamese, South Vietnamese civilians, so they were not considered people who you could do a war crime on, because you're killing your own people. So they just charged him with murder under the Uniform Code.
Well, one of the gentlemen I work with at Pullman, he's, I don't know, he's a little older than me. If he's still around, I hope he is. But he was he had a job in Vietnam. He worked. Remember the name Lear Sigler?
Vaguely.
Well, they're a company that did a lot of airplane components at the time. I'm sure they were bought by somebody. And that list you sent us about everybody got bought by everybody, right?
Yeah.
And but they used to send planes over there that you could fly, but you really couldn't do much else with them. So they would land and they would send the completed parts, because of course they already got paid because the thing was delivered, even though the thing couldn't fly. His job was to go from airfield to airfield with, like, the, you know, this control piece that went in the dashboard, so he'd have 10 of them in his Jeep to go, you know, and he was a pretty electronic guy. He'd go put the things in there so the next day they could take the thing off and, you know, and fly it. Well, he said there'd be a list of, like, roads that they had checked for mines. And he goes, they'd put the list up there. It didn't make any difference whether the lift was up there or not. That didn't mean they actually checked them. He says, you're driving along and everybody's waving at you. He says, if you made it home after dark, the same people are shooting at you. The guy said it was an absolute disaster under any sort. It was totally undefined. And I don't know how, you know, a lot of guys, he said, were killed because they'd head off to the bar at night and get killed coming back because they thought everybody was okay and they weren't. I mean, it was just absolutely a mess. And psychologically, it just screwed you up totally.
Well, yeah, because... We were trained at that time, and again, remember, we're using a drafted army, and you do things with draftees, or you have to do things with draftees that you don't do with guys that you can hold on to for, you know, 4 to 6 years. But we were confronting an enemy who was provoking. You know, the Viet Cong did not follow the laws of armed conflict. The North Vietnamese trained them to use their citizen population as a screen and as cover, but also as combatants. And we were not prepared. Our drafted army was not prepared to deal with a situation where they were going to have to shoot children and women who were carrying weapons and trying to attack them. And they were not prepared to deal with the implications of that, which is you can't, you know, you can't treat civilians the way we would normally want to treat civilians. If we're supposed to be winning the hearts and minds of these people, and that was a phrase that came out of,
Was that McNamara?
I believe it was.
Yeah.
But if we're trying to win the hearts and minds, we can't shoot. You know, we can't go around willy-nilly shooting civilians. You may remember the movie American Sniper, where the protagonist sees this kid, you know, walking down the street with, I think it's an RPG, and he has to shoot him. You know, it's like some 10-year-old,
yeah.
And he has to shoot him and kill him. And you know, for us, this is a very, very difficult thing. It's a terrible thing, but for the people we're fighting, they don't care. And this is, by the way, what the Israelis are confronting, you know, every day in Gaza. So the implication there, the fallout from this episode was to get us, I mean, it was one of the results was to get us out of this mindset that we can just take guys, give them 6 weeks of basic training, and then effectively throw them over there into this situation and expect them to operate, you know, effectively as U.S. ambassadors in a situation where you've got this kind of moral fog of war.
Yeah, and you're
that's
a jungle.
Induced by the enemy.
You're in a jungle. But, you know, Lou, the mentality shift a little bit here, because I think we probably talked enough about it.
I mean do you remember the Apocalypse Now, the movie?
Yeah.
Okay. Fantastic scene in that movie where Marlon Brando is talking to Sheen about dealing with the Viet Cong and how he was a Green Beret guy. So they had been doing civic action, and part of the civic action program was going in and providing, you know, basically childhood inoculations. So they go into a village and they inoculate the children for, you know, measles, mumps, all the diseases that they could catch there. Then they give them some antibiotics and a bunch of other stuff. And the Viet Cong come through behind them, and they take these kids that they've inoculated, and they cut the arms off of every child, the arm off of every child who got a shot.
That's special.
And that was, you know, I remember when I saw that in the movie, it triggered a memory. Something like that actually happened. And the point of it was the sheer will of the people that they were fighting, who were willing to do that, you know, meant that it was going to be almost impossible for us to defeat them unless we annihilated them. But when you are facing an enemy that has that kind of vision, your Western rules for, you know, how you deal with combatants and non-combatants go out the window, and it gives you a little more perspective on what the people in the AmeriCal division, that was Cali's people, were facing and how they reacted.
Well, when you're the winner gets to write the rules of war, right? And they were sort of winning, so they brought it down to the lowest level you could get.
Well,
but you know,
third world countries, when the Geneva Conventions were enacted and we started talking about, you know, hey, look, here are the rules by which we fight. One of the things that you got out of a lot of these third world revolutionary movements were a statement to the effect of, we're not going to fight by those rules because those rules favor you guys. We're not going to fight
well,
by
they do.
Those rules.
They do, to a certain, to a large extent.
Yeah.
It's like me going up to Mike Tyson and him saying we're gonna do Marcus Queensberry rules, and you and I are saying, no, we're not.
Yeah.
Not against you, we're not.
Well, again, if we get into conflict with people like this, I think the right move, and but our press organs are not capable of doing this, the right move is to stand back and say, okay, the Israelis, you know, kill civilians. You know, whose fault is that? Well, it's the fault of Hamas. It's not the fault of Israel. Israel is fighting as best they can against an enemy that's trying to provoke this response. So the moral indignation should not be directed at Tel Aviv. The moral indignation should be directed at Rafah and at these people. And oh, by the way, the latest round of Israeli intelligence successes is doing a pretty good job of holding the instigators of that conflict responsible at a very personal level.
Yeah, they nailed knocked a couple of guys up. You know, when you talk about people rolling with the rules, there's kind of two real quick stories. Like, one of the first ones like this, and it's nothing about Vietnam, is that I was reading this book on World War One, and the naval conflicts always were, you know, there were rules. You're supposed to have ships. You're supposed to line them up and shoot at each other. And, oh, by the way, if you knocked off the other guy, you're supposed to pick up survivors, right? Well, the Germans invented this thing called a submarine. Some ship comes by, and they torpedo it, and the thing goes down, and people in the water all over the damn place. Another ship comes by to pick up survivors, and they torpedo that one. And so now the British immediately run to the Geneva Convention Center and say, this is BS, you can't do this, you can't shoot a ship when you don't have ability to pick up survivors. And the Germans are like laughing at them, like, guys, we got a new toy here, it's all on us, I mean, screw you guys, type of thing. And, you know,
the
submarine was
the
essentially
German, the Germans. The Germans said, we can't pick up survivors. We're a submarine.
Yeah.
We don't have room.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry. You know, do a better job of you know, training your people, whatever. So,
well, you know, you see that in Chicago real quick. I know it's changed a little bit towards what's going on in the world today. But some of this stuff, you like to forget it, Lou, but you sort of can't. Because, I mean, this week I was talking about this guy in the neighborhood and how he was a Vietnam guy and he had a diabetes thing on Monday or last Saturday, and it was pretty awful for me, but I got him an ambulance and he's okay. But so that part's good. I should have recognized it a little quicker and should have had some orange juice looking back on it, but I didn't. Anyway, but how many people came back from them and just never reentered society and just never really got a real job, never really, all their friends were married, everybody was gone, their family didn't let them back in or they moved. It was really, really awful. I mean, I know the same sort of thing probably happened for Iraq and Afghanistan people, but not to the same extent where you came back here and people didn't like you. mean, it was yeah. really something. But the other thing, what's happening in Chicago here, and my late friend Judge Tooman, when he died after, or he retired, then died soon after. He didn't retire. He was like 82 or something. But he was the head of the child courts, children's court, whatever you want to call mm-hmm. it, juvenile court. And when he died, there was about three or four articles about how, you know, basically good riddance, because he was too hard on these juveniles. And yet, in Illinois, you have a bifurcation, if we use that term for law. We probably have some of the hardest gun laws here, you'd never know it, of any state for adults, yet we have some of the easiest laws on anything for juveniles. So you sit there and go, wait a minute, if these guys, these people running around shooting everybody, if they are somewhat rational, which I think they are in some extent, what's going to happen? Every gang of four people now has somebody underage that's like carrying the guns. So when you if you get caught, the juvenile's got the gun and you let him out at night. Where the other people, I mean, there's minimums here in the state. I mean, you probably know better than me. My guys I see on Wednesday would know. Well, if you use a gun in a robbery, I mean, it's what is it, minimum 10 years? I mean, it's serious stuff in Illinois. I mean, they don't catch anybody, but if you do, I mean, you don't want to be caught using a gun here. I mean, it's serious stuff.
But your prosecutor.
I understand that, but I'm saying
wasn't charging this.
I understand that, but I'm saying the laws split like this, and what Tooman was doing was saying, hey, you can't let these kids out of the system. They're dangerous, even though they're only 17 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And he was getting all kinds of grief about it, and yet everybody's dying. I mean, but I'm saying when you split something like that and say, okay, if you're over 18, you're going to jail for 30 years. If you're under 18, we're letting you out that night. Guess what happens? The guy under 18 carries the gun. Right? I mean, duh.
Sure.
That's what happened on the West Side case here, where the two guys, two cops, which, again, as little bit of knowledge of police work that I have from my family members, you know, if you think there's shooters in an alley, two guys don't walk down the alley with their gun out. You make sure you have backup. I don't think they back each other up here that well. I don't know. I'm not in the hood, but these two guys go down the alley. There's an older guy and a younger guy. The younger guy pulls out the gun to throw it to the ground. The officer shoots him. He didn't realize the kid was going to toss it because he was afraid. He thought.
Yeah,
he was
I remember. I remember seeing the video.
Well, of course, the kid's what? 16, and the other guy is 21. Mm-hmm. So, oh my God, you shot the juvenile. Well, the juvenile probably didn't pull the trigger on whatever the other guy shot a while ago. He just handed him the gun and said, "You carry it." It's awful. I mean, it's.
But yeah, it is. But in the split second where you have to make that.
I wasn't there. I don't know.
Yeah, that decision. When you see the gun come out, you shoot.
Well, I understand that, but I'm just saying I would have liked to have seen more cops at all the other ends of the alley rather than these two guys going down there in the dark by themselves. I mean, that's just me. But and all the stuff you see on TV about how police work is supposed to be, you don't see that here. Anyway, let's talk about something better after the break, Lou. I'm sure you always have good stuff, but this Vietnam thing is... It's so freaky, and it's sort of happening again. I mean, you're seeing people in the guys that are running out doing the pirate stuff. I mean, are they? I bet there's kids on those boats, aren't there?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. No. That's you know, if you're a 13 or 14 year old, I mean, look up the lyrics to the song "Patriot Game."
Yeah.
By the Irish, you know, with the Irish Republican Army ballad. And you know, the doc talks about a 14-year-old who you know, is dying.
You don't want to probably know the answer to this. Remember the book April Morning?
Yes.
How old was that kid? Was he 16?
Maybe.
I was going to say maybe.
Yeah. I thought he was younger, but he might have been 16.
Real brief story. I mean, it's an interesting book. It had to do with the first shot fired basically in the Revolutionary War. Where these people, this kid's dad and a bunch of people said, no, the British can't go any further than here. And they had guns, but they weren't even loaded, right? So the British pulled out a bunch of guns and shot these guys, shot the kid's dad. Well, all of a sudden, the rest of the day, everybody was behind basically a tree or a bush shooting at redcoats. So they ended up, a citizen's army was born like in a day, right, in that area, right? And the kid said he knocked off three or four, and he might have been 15 or 16. All of a sudden, the British were fighting, and essentially the same thing we were fighting in Vietnam, right?
Yes.
And it's anyway, SP Futures up 27, NASDAQ Futures up 120. Come back, we'll talk about some more pleasant stuff. We promise, Stocks and Jocks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom, Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 27. NASDAQ Futures up 122. The big star this morning is Meta up $40. That's 8%. They came out with earnings that beat a little bit, but they we're talking about rarefied air. There's no such thing as looking at the value anymore, which is fine. These companies might very well grow into these values, and they could be a rock and buy here. I mean, we will see. I sort of question that. I'm more of a fundamental kind of guy, but by the way, that being fundamental has left you a little bit slow on the market for a while. You know, maybe things will come back to value, maybe they won't. Over in Asia, we got the Nikkei down 975. It's 2.5%. Not sure why that is. 38,126. Hang Seng down 39. Still over 17,000 on the big rally yesterday. We were 17,304. Shanghai still languishing under 3,000, down 6 points, 2932. So they're not kind of going anywhere over there. Although the Asian market, I mean, some of the Australian markets and stuff were at record highs, so it's really mixed. DAX down 137.7%. CAC Iran down 59.8%. FTSE Alber is up 19.2%. The Bank of England is going to come up with their decision today, I believe. Again, the Fed held everything even yesterday, but they definitely greased the wheels for a September cut. In so many words, as Powell is totally dovish, which is fine. You know, I mean, that's what he's doing right now. Yesterday, the Dow was up 99, S&P up 85. NASDAQ, however, was up 451, 2.6%. That's a long, long way. Bunds down 5 basis points, 4.05. Rates keep going lower. The Fed must already be lowering or pouring money into the system, as you can see by the money supply. The Bund down 1 basis point, 2.29. Japan down 3 basis points, 1.03. Oil up 64 cents, 78.55, so still kind of at the lower end of the range. Brent down up 60 cents, 80.83. Natural gas unchanged, 204. Arbub unchanged, 245. Gold had a huge rally yesterday. Is back up again today, 950, 2482. Was just under 2300 like last week. Silver up 14 cents, 2908. Copper down 3 cents, 413. Foreign exchange. Euro 107.8, so the dollar's up a little bit. Same thing against the pound, 127.8, so the dollar's up. Against the yen is up to 150.47, still way below the 161, so it has strengthened quite a bit in the last few weeks. Stuff going all over the place here. Crypto down, Bitcoin down 1,100, 64,042, down from its 67,000 high. Greg, a lot of stuff there. You got to give us a commodity report. What do you have for us, traffic, weather, and sports?
Morning, everyone. 6:40 here in Chicago. We have 73 degrees right now. Some localized downpours and wind today. High of 85. Phoenix, 88. Currently, intervals of clouds and sunshine. Very hot today and tomorrow. High of 106 today. Traffic is getting worse. We've got Lollapalooza here in the loop also. Inbound Kennedy from Montrose is 26 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook, 48 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 27 minutes. The Ryan from 95th, 17 minutes. And Stevenson, 294 to the Ryan, is 29 minutes. Got some baseball. Royals beat the White Sox on the south side. That was 10-3. Nationals lose at Diamondbacks 4-5, and the Cubs win at the Reds 13-4. Olympics, we've got men's basketball beating South Sudan. That team, fun fact, is almost completely sponsored by former Bull Luol Deng. And the Olympic medal tracker, U.S. currently has 31 medals, France 26 medals, and China 12 medals. So, that's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
What kind of medals are you talking about?
Olympic medals.
I'm talking about the real sport at the Olympics.
The real sport?
200,000
track and field.
200,000 male condoms, 20,000 female condoms, 10,000 oral dams, whatever those are, available to the Olympic Village. Safe sex is paramount in a notoriously febrile environment. I never saw that word before. Akin to students at college, but a lot sweatier.
Interesting.
And that's in the Olympic, stated on the Olympic site.
It's like cicadas, once every 4 years or whatever.
Yeah.
You gotta get, do what you gotta
do. So what if, you know, so you really want to be in an event that's real easy and is over the first day, like archery or something, and just hang around for 2 weeks.
Archery's easy, huh?
You think Luke could get lucky with a gold medal hanging around his neck?
I don't know if the archers have the kind of physiques that are going to draw, you know, the kind of interest that you're talking about. It's the gymnasts and the, you know, I remember reading something about this in, I think, Tokyo, where they got a couple of the female athletes who remained unnamed to basically talk about, you know, yeah, we're, you know, targeting certain guys.
God, well, that always, gee, that never changes.
I just thought, well, you know, I'm guessing whoever those guys are, they don't have a chance.
They're being ambushed.
That's right.
So what are you saying? When the artists are a bunch of fatsos?
No, I'm just saying that they would tend to be, I would think, like the shooting sports, they tend to be older. They don't tend to have the kind of physiques that, you know, inspire people to stalk them and plan to go after them.
Stalk them?
No.
I don't think I've ever been stalked. I mean, I don't know, is that good or bad?
I don't think, well, you would know if you did.
That's right. I'm just gonna say that the average guy, frankly, is pretty oblivious to being stalked until it slaps him in the face.
Guys are pretty oblivious about a lot of stuff. That's what makes them attractive, yeah. I guess.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And I, you know, the literature is full of fictional and historic accounts of women who finally get some guy and they basically say, you know, what was wrong with, what's wrong with you? I practically had to slap you or undress in front of you to get you to pay attention. And, you know, I mean, guys are just oblivious.
Well, I will say this, that if I had been in the Olympics, like, you know, how many years ago, even if I didn't get lucky, I would have grabbed a bunch of those condoms that say Olympics on them and had them on my desk for the rest of my life.
Just as a conversation.
Just as a conversation.
A conversation.
Oh, so you were in the Olympics. Yeah, these are a few leftover ones.
Replace that one.
I wouldn't say that I stole 10 and I still have 10.
Look at this. What do you think so far?
Or I'd say I stole 100. I only got 3 left. God.
You chose to keep the 3.
Yeah, I chose to keep the 3. By the way, who gets the contract for these things?
It's probably a sponsorship, sure, right?
Yeah, it's probably a sponsorship.
Some local supplier or some sponsor. I mean, would you really advertise your product as, you know, the official condom of the Paris Olympics?
Why not?
I don't know. It doesn't sound like a much of a selling point.
I got one real stupid question, and then we'll get on to some more important. The people that are doing the surfing, they're in Tahiti. Now, do they get flown back for the closing ceremonies or the opening ceremonies?
I assume they do.
How long does it take to get from Tahiti to Paris, for God's sake?
I'd say it's a bit of a haul. But I'm pretty sure I assume there are nonstop flights from Paris, right?
Well, yeah, one of my judge buddies last night said that he watched some of that, and he goes, wherever they were, he goes, every guy that got on a board looked like it was a death-defying thing. The waves they had were unbelievable.
There's some, if it's the place I'm thinking of, there was a documentary about, what was his name, Laird Hamilton? Is that the surfer? Who was riding some incredible curl, but it was right above, or it ended right on top of this coral reef. So you were surfing in, you know, 25 to 30 feet of water with these perfect waves. But when they broke, if you didn't ride it out in a specific area, you found yourself in 6 to 8 inches of water over a coral reef.
Ooh.
And yeah. So I mean, it's, I guess, great waves, but, you know, big danger. So that's
the way it works. You're our guy, as we talk about markets, everybody else, we sure will when Dan comes in. World events. Ukraine, what's Ukraine? Red Sea, what's Red Sea? Pirates, we don't care. Ships going around Africa.
Well,
are they? Is any now we've got the Middle East, which to me is, it could blow into a huge war in 2 weeks. I hope it does not. But none of this stuff is even paid attention to a second by, oh man, Meta's worth $4 trillion in that too. I mean, this is bizarre world here in the currency world.
Well, you had a major political event in your city yesterday.
Yeah.
You had President Trump appear at that Association of Black Journalists, and I don't think this came up. You know,
I saw some of it.
I mean, I saw some of it too. I don't think foreign policy came up.
No, and, disagree with me, please, because I'm going to say with the people we have running, and I'm not going to point fingers at either one, we're going to make it all the way to the election with not one single major issue being defined by either one of them.
Trump has taken some positions. I think he's defined positions. Harris has not made a press appearance.
Well, they're not. Neither one of them is going to put a position paper down on what they're going to do about this massive inflation bubble that's burying half their people. Nobody's going to talk about national debt. Nobody's going to talk about.
Why do you got to be so down? What's going on?
Well, I'm just saying.
Raining on the parade here. We were talking about the Olympics.
Yeah, well, but my point is, we're never going to.
Condoms.
Condoms.
There are, if two people are running for office here, there's
looking
a
looking out for the people, the listeners. Yeah.
But I mean, there's five things that probably the three of us, you know, Greg will never agree with anything, but there's five items on there that we would think are pretty important, be it relations with China, be it what are we going to do about Ukraine?
Drugs, sex, rock
drugs,
and roll.
Yeah, you know, drugs for sure. Homelessness, immigration, and by the way, money supply, inflation. Nobody can afford a house. Nobody can afford a car. I don't think we're going to get any of these two to ever sit down and we'll know what. You get some kind of an idea where the Republicans and Trump feel. And obviously, you get some kind of an idea where this lady feels if she's going to do the same thing Biden was doing. But I don't want that. I want them to actually tell me what they're going to do.
Well,
I'm not going to get
okay.
it.
Okay, so Harris's people repudiated her position on four major policy areas within the last 2 days, inexplicably. You know, and I mean that when I say that, I mean without explanation, that she just reversed herself. You know, she had said I'm in favor of I'm opposed to fracking, and we're going to stop it. Now she's not opposed to fracking.
Well, she's got to be in favor of it, or else she falls right under the specter of the people in the Middle East again. Nobody wants to do that.
But this administration has said Joe Biden says he's declaring war on fossil fuels.
Yeah, except we're up 2.5 million barrels a day since he's been in there. So what he says and what he did are totally different.
Tom, I'm just you wanted them to stake out policy positions.
Yeah.
To the extent that she is going to.
I guess I meant real ones, Lou. I guess I meant real ones.
I mean, then you can tell me what are real and what aren't. I think you'll see something at the debate where people will try to force some kind of definitive statements out of these folks. I was fascinated by the fact that you know, Trump decides he's going to go literally into the lion's den and take on a very hostile crowd. And my hat's off to the guy for doing that. I don't agree with everything he said. I thought it was pretty funny that he went after Harris on her heritage.
What do you mean? It's his playbook since day one with Obama.
Well, but
he's got only one
playbook. But you know, doing it in that environment by saying, you know, well, yeah, you're claiming her as being black, but she campaigned as being Indian, and let's be real. This is what if you're going to play the race card, then I'm going to play the race card too. I'm not going to play it in the way you like it, but I'm going to play it. And I just thought that was, I thought from a strategic point, that was pretty interesting. But I give him a lot of credit, and I think you should too, at going into that environment and you know, saying, okay, here I am, let's go. And again, with the understanding that she was going to be there, and you know, she backed out, but that she was gonna you know, get on the stage with him. And I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, I sort of did too, actually.
I don't agree with a lot of stuff he said, or everything he said, or how he said it, but you know, this is the world we're in right now.
He's trying to find which he has been good at, and by the way, it seems to draws support. What he's good at is insulting the hell out of the other person. He's trying to find the thing here. I mean, with Rubio, it was how small his hands were. When you know what he really meant. I mean, everybody knows what he really meant. He wasn't a manly man, and you know, and he tries to get this thing. Now he had Biden right where he wanted him, an old doddering guy. So he had his.
Well, he didn't have to do.
No, but he sharpened up. I know, but he sharpened up on that.
All now, he had to do with Biden was wait till the drugs wore off.
But now he's got somebody new, and he's got to find a hole here. He's got to find a way to insult her that doesn't bounce back on him, and it's taken him a little bit actually. And he finally settled on the race card, which is the same thing with Obama.
Well, I think he's going to, I mean, but he's not the one that played the race card first. You know, she did.
Well,
and you've got to be, I mean, I'm disturbed at the racial affinity groups and gender affinity groups.
Oh, so am I.
That are coming online and saying, okay, you know, we're operating like this because it's divisive and silly, frankly. If you saw the excerpts of the white women for Kamala Zoom call and what happened on that thing, silly and, you know, counterproductive in the long run. But this is the, you know, he looks at this and says, okay, well, if we're going to play this game, I'm going to push buttons. They're going to push buttons. I'm going to push buttons. The reaction from the corporate press is going to be very different for her pushing buttons versus me pushing buttons. But I'm going to push him anyway.
Well, we have a mutual friend whose daughter is vocal, shall we say. And she and her friends, they just all turned 18. They're all graduating high school. They graduated this year, whatever. They just got voting age. And they had zero interest in voting or registering until she was in the race because they absolutely wanted no part of an old white guy, no matter who it was. It could have been George Marshall, for God's sake. That's what they've been taught. And
yeah.
And, you know, the young people, I guess when we were young, we weren't too happy about the old people either. But
they might just think that, too.
Well, but they're all registering. That doesn't matter in Illinois because the Democrats win all the time no matter what. But how much of that's going on? I mean, what is?
I don't know if it's that what they were taught. I mean, that might be it. But they could actually say, "Nah, we're done with."
Well, I mean, obviously, it shows. I mean, when I was growing up, even the TV shows, the you know, you had a whole bunch of people that came back from the war and did a lot of really good stuff. You didn't make fun of the males all day long. That wasn't the joke on every single TV show. You look at the 50s show, when at the end of the day, the old man would save the day. And then you got to the 70s, and all of a sudden the old man's an idiot, and every 5-year-old kid's smarter than the old man. Right, right, Lou?
I mean, it's gotten even worse than that.
Oh, yeah, way worse than that.
You know, these young women are saying, oh, no, we're all in favor of Kamala. Kamala, I guarantee you that there are an equal number of young men who are turning 18 and who look around and go, why on earth would I vote for a Democrat, given the war on me
been
waged for the last 20 years? And I've got my nephew. I've got a nephew who's in his early 20s, and my relatives, who are unabashedly, you know, progressives, are horrified that this kid is conservative and is gonna vote Republican, and they look at it as a moral failing. And I was trying to explain to them, he's come up through a school system that demonizes him from day one. You don't think this is a normal reaction to this kind of thing? The polls, I'm not sure I can trust any of the polling data from now until well after the election. But the polling data is showing a definitive shift on the part of young men, you know, between 20 and 30 to Trump and to the Republicans because of exactly what you described, Tom.
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. And as much as a person, I didn't like the guy long before he ever ran because I knew people in New York, he didn't pay and things like that. So that's just me. I never could vote for Hillary because she got trades in her account that weren't hers. And to me, that's something you just don't ever do. And if somebody who's willing to let that happen has character flaws that I just think got to be pretty bad. So I feel the same way about Trump, to be
honest
with you.
Not to mention the murders.
Oh, yeah, those too. But I also know that for my business, Trump, when he was in there, corralled the Department of Labor's incredible takeover of the securities business when it comes to IRAs. And all the stuff that was happening during the Obama administration was put on hold. And as soon as this guy came in, it came flying out again. And now it's all over the place. And matter of fact, one of the very liberal attorneys I was talking to last week, a friend of our mutual friend, I said, well, you know, what about the fiduciary thing? This thing is a disaster. And he goes, Chief, how can you possibly say that being a fiduciary for somebody is a disaster? I said, wait a minute. What is your definition of a fiduciary? Well, somebody who cares more about their client than they do about themselves in terms of making money. I said, I've been one of those forever. Forever.
Yeah, that's a standard.
That's a standard, but that's not their definition.
No, I know.
He goes, what are you talking about? I said, when's the last time you had a tire changed? Well, a couple of months ago. So what happened? I went in with a leak in the tire. The guy sold me a tire. I said, he can't do that under their definition. He goes, what are you talking about? I said, Mick, his name is Mick. I go, under their definition, you have to go in and pay somebody to check out your tire. And if he says you need a new tire, he like writes you a prescription and you go somewhere else and you walk in and say, I need a tire. If he sells you the tire, he's considered whatever you want. What's the term? He's considered
a guarantor.
He's selling you the tire because that's how he makes money, whether or not you needed one or not. He goes, that can't be the definition. I go, yeah, it is. they're telling me as a broker, if you walk in and say, I really want to buy J.P. Morgan, and I'll say, what do you think? And I go, I don't know. Everybody says they're the best bank. I'll say, oh, you know, I'll give you some. I can charge him for that conversation. Okay, but if I say, well, here, if you want to buy some J.P. Morgan, you know, whatever, I'll charge you $50. Oh, no. You can't be a fiduciary if you make money from, but that means your dentist could never fill your tooth. Your doctor could never operate on you or give you a prescription or your tire or anything else. If that definition was applied to society here, society would fall apart. It all comes down to trusting a person, right? That's not their definition.
Yes. Just, well,
now, what manner of moron comes up with that?
And so I think the people that Trump has surrounded himself with are hostile to this kind of administrative state rulemaking and lawmaking.
They are, yeah.
And I think it's one of the reasons I would think you would vote for him. It's a big one.
But you got to take all the other crap that comes with it.
Well, but the alternative is a rapidly increasing administrative state that has proven beyond anybody's doubt that they are anti-First Amendment. They are coercive and censorious. That they would use government power to shut down the opinions of people they don't like, as a minimum, that they have absolutely no respect for the Constitution because of what they've done with Joe Biden and how they concealed a failing executive. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't like Ms. Harris, but she should be president right now. And the fact that they lied and conspired to keep
is enough
of an indictment for me.
Right, funny you brought that up. Let's take a minute over here. Do you think that would be a plus or minus for her if he were to say, you know, I'm just out?
I don't know, but I want constitutional regularity. You know, in matters of how we are governed, I want constitutional regularity. If in fact what Seymour Hersh says is true, and it rings true to me. You know, they went to him. Obama went to him and said, "We're going to force you out unless you agree not to run." And that caused him to withdraw.
Why doesn't that's supposed to be the cabinet's job, right?
I mean, that's a coup.
But I mean, it's supposed to be the cabinet's job.
It is supposed to be the cabinet's job, but if the cabinet and the vice president believe that you are not competent such that we can exercise the 25th Amendment as a credible threat, then you need to be out of there.
Well, the only thing I will say about that, Lou, is the people that I've, you know, everybody goes through this. People in their family get older and older. Sometimes it happens so rapidly, and you're sort of in denial, and then one week you walk in and go, God, it's gotten so much worse than last week. I better do something about it.
This didn't happen that way.
I don't know. I don't know the man. So it's been the physical stuff, you know, grabbing the railing and things like that. I mean, that happens to everybody. But all of a sudden,
Tom, there were people around him in 2020 that were saying he shouldn't be running because he's not mentally competent.
Really?
This is one of the greatest deceptions.
What do you think he has?
Unconstitutional deceptions practiced on the American public in our history.
What do you think he has? Just general aging or what?
No, I think he's got dementia. And I don't think it's just generally aging. I think he's got definitive cognitive decline.
Reagan went and hid his last couple years.
Well, so did Biden. Biden started hiding. Biden started hiding in the campaign in 2020.
Well, Roosevelt's decline was all physical, I think. So that you can't count that. Woodrow Wilson was. His was
mental. Wilson had a stroke or whatever it was. Yeah. But he was cognitively impaired.
Yeah, but I mean, wasn't Roosevelt pretty much all physical? He just started. His blood pressure was what, 2-something over 150.
I mean, he failed. But this will go down as an unconstitutional, you know, power grab that was maintained for years, and it's horrific. And anybody that participated in it, and she did, in my opinion, she should be impeached.
How can you be impeached? We're not even in there yet.
Oh, she can be impeached as vice president.
Well, I guess we can have all kinds of views, and people on your side are going to have their view. Say your side. I'm in the middle, so I'm not on any side. But I mean, whatever it is, it always should have happened earlier, right?
Yes.
I mean, you know.
But you got to remember that Biden. It should have happened in 2020. You have to remember that Biden was a panic choice. Because Bernie Sanders was about to win the nomination, fair and square, and the Democratic elites altered the rules, shut down his campaign, and effectively they needed somebody to desperately to install who they could prop up as likable and electable, and they had this mentally declining, pliable guy that they could throw in there, and that's what they did.
Well, you know,
that's what it looks like.
What did Wayne Manson, we got a dash here, what did Wayne Manson say that when it happened, it was, and he, you know, all history of this stuff, is that it was almost like the chaos that a lot of people thought was the Trump stuff. He said it was almost like when they put Konrad Adenauer in over in, was it in France?
Germany.
Or Germany, where they knew, but he was probably more mentally aware than Biden.
He was reasonably sure.
Yeah, and they said they put him in there, you're not going to change the world, he's just going to stabilize things for a while till we figure out where we want to go.
Well, and I mean, Biden was put in there not to stabilize things. He was put in there because we have to maintain power, and we can't stand another 4 years of having our guts ripped out, which is what was happening under Trump.
Well, the same thing happened when they anointed Bush after Clinton. Republicans are so pissed off they hated Clinton. I mean, it happens on both sides, right?
I can't compare Clinton derangement syndrome, which is a with Trump derangement syndrome.
No, but Clinton, his issue was he got in there too soon. He was a trial run for the next election, right? When Bush disintegrated, nobody thought he was going to win. There had to be four or five guys that were above the chain than Clinton, right? And none of them wanted to run because Bush was a shoo-in. And Clinton goes, "I'll do it because in 4 years then I'll win." And all of a sudden he wins.
Yeah, well, he won because of Ross Perot.
Well, he also won because Bush was he didn't think he needed a campaign at all, and Clinton's a good campaigner.
Well, Ross Perot made the difference in that election.
He was a character. You know, he and his son's one of my big clients, unfortunately, decided to leave the country. Talk about losing a big client. And he gave up his citizenship, even though the guy was a World War II vet. And he became a citizen of the Isle of Man with residency in Bermuda, which is really hard to get, by the way. And I think his neighbors were Ross Perot and her two kids that had already escaped the place while the guy was running. You can't write fiction like this, Lou. He runs into Ross Perot on the beach. I go, you got to be kidding me. No. There he was. What the hell? SP Futures up 22, NASDAQ Futures up 85. What are you doing? You're back from the... You all rested up from your vacay?
No, I'm still dealing with time zone changes and circadian rhythms and all that good stuff.
I'll tell you what, it sounded like a great trip, though.
It was. It really was.
All right, buddy, talk at you next week. You want to go for a quick break or you want to go right to Dan, Mr. Producer Greg? Go right to Dan. Dan, how are you, buddy?
I'm great. How are you?
All right. I didn't talk about the market at all for the first hour that much because I want you to tell me what the hell over you and Greg, what with the commodities flying all over the place. We can't figure out where they're pouring
Nvidia's
money into the system.
Nvidia's trading like a penny stock.
Yeah, Nvidia is like up and down 20%, even though you got
Microsoft lost 10% just because of Flash.
But then it came right back.
Yeah, it came
and
back.
And then Meta was the same. Yeah, the volatility is amazing, and this is what I anticipated, what I've been predicting as the year goes on. And you know, you see earnings that are beating, but then you know you see these wild runs up, like we did, for example, in Microsoft, and then all of a sudden you see this pullback. And this goes back to me telling people right now that sell on to these huge rallies and then buy on the big dips. And this is a very easy time to make money if you do that in the near term. But yeah, you got to like roller coasters to be in this market.
Well, you have to have I don't normally give investment advice, but for years, and Greg, this is kind of a futures gig, but for years, I mean, if you wanted to just, for instance, trade futures, or you wanted to trade Nvidia, say, which is pretty darn hard to do, by the way, if you want to trade the stock. It traded for Thursday morning. Tuesday night, it was 100. Did it trade 100 or 100, 103 cents or something? And now it's 132. Well, right. Okay, that's... I'm saying it's 120. Well, that's $20 times 224 billion shares right. Outstanding. That's like a lot of money. But what you always could do if you wanted to be safe, Dan... Oh, God, I'm going to be too technical here. If you want to just be a guy who can scalp futures back and forth, but you want to be protected, and what Dan says, okay, if let's say the futures or a stock or something runs way down and you want to be a buyer, okay, well, if you just buy it, you're kind of naked out there, and you hope you go at the bottom. The problem is if the futures are down 200 points or, let's say, 50 points and you think it's a low, and you buy it, and all of a sudden they're down 75. Like, now what do you do? Because you probably really like to buy another one, but you can't because you're sitting there going, what if it goes down 100? But what you could buy the straddle by the call and the put. So every time you bought low, you were covered by the put, and every time you sold high, you were covered by the call. You could do that. But I think virtually every time during my career, which has been a long time, you never could scalp enough or count on scalping enough to where you'd pay for the time decay on the straddle, because every day you're paying money for this, quote, insurance on both sides. I think, Dan, the thing that has changed in the last year or two or three, I think you could almost make money doing that. And the reason why I say that is because, you know, I do a lot of earnings plays. And what I do, I look at the straddle, and I think there should be some sort of a connection between the straddle and the calendar spread, or the time spread, whatever you want to call it. So if the straddle is $20, the world is telling you that they believe that the stock is going to move plus or minus, you know, it's going to have a 60-some percent chance of moving $20 inside or out, you know, and not much chance of it moving outside, but some, right? And so I look at that and I say, well, if the straddle's $20, the time spread should be like $2, okay? But if it's not, if it's like $1 or 80 cents,
right.
I look at and say, well, there's a mix-up here. They should align somehow, and they're not. So I buy them if they're cheap, basically. And, you know, sometimes you win a few in a row, sometimes you lose a few in a row, but once in a while you'll catch one where you really kind of catch one, and it should pay for the rest. That's the theory of it. Well, I'll tell you I'm saying we've had stuff that's two and three and four times straddle like I've never seen. The 3M, the straddle was $6. The stock was up 24 hours. I've never seen that in a essentially a staid stock. We're not talking about, you know, a dot bomb company. Virtually every time now, the straddle is 150-200% of what, or the move is 1.5-200% the straddle. I mean, I've never seen that in all my years here. Now, of course, if I started buying them, you know, they wouldn't do that. But I mean, what we're saying is even the market can't figure out what the market's doing.
Right. No, I agree with. So that approach, I think, that you're discussing makes a lot of sense. And I think the other approach, which is what I'm suggesting, is for somebody who has a more conservative portfolio like the ones I generally manage that are more fixed income driven, capital preservation driven, you can on the side nibble when you're buying and you can trim when you're selling. So it's not going in a full way and making that decision, that investment decision to get into the market. It's just buying on the edges. So we did, for example, when we saw that big sell-off, we ended up buying the Qs, QQQ. We ended up buying some VTI, which is the Vanguard Total Stock Index. And we ended up buying some IJR, which is the Russell 2000, the small caps. And we did very well. And what we did is we bought, and this is the way that I tend to trade, is because the majority of the portfolio is going to be in more secure investments, income-driven investments. But on the edges, if you want to take a certain percentage and put them into the equity market when there's a huge sell-off, just do that in a small way. So that, to answer your question, so what do you do when it drops further? Then you can buy a little more if your outlook is for upside in the market. But all that being said, I totally agree with you that it's a very difficult market to understand right now. There's still a fair amount of money in the system. And it feels like that snowball effect whereas, you know, it grows and you have more money now to spend, so you put more money in the market. And I would think that a fair number of people who are in the big four, the big seven tech names are just reinvesting the money that they're making. So that's how, you know, the valuations get so stretched, and that's how this, what I call inflation, my personal belief, inflation in the equity market is happening. So we had some good news yesterday from the Fed. I heard Powell's speech and all the contact afterwards, but I do believe, and I do agree that the situation in the labor market is coming to better balance. You know, unemployment is up a little. I'm talking 4.1%. It's now at the level where it was pre-pandemic. So that is one part of their dual mandate. The dual mandate is maximum employment.
You mean they're the two little things in their mandate. The number one thing is to maintain wealth.
On this one, I'm a little more optimistic that they're on track with that, because I think the way we've seen the employment market work has been we've seen gradual improvement. On the other side, stable pricing, that is where I have an issue. So the employment side I get, and we have facts that back up what's happening. We also can look out and talk to our friends and our friends' kids who are working for companies and that have taken away benefits or having layoffs, or companies that have made it difficult for people to work remotely. So that has been a good thing. So I'm okay on the labor side. Where I'm not totally okay is on the other side of their mandate, which is stability of prices and the inflation. And this is where I think, Chief, you and I are on the same page. You know, PCE going up 2.5%. Yeah, that's a good number. That makes a lot of sense. But I think there is still parts of the inflation picture that are not being the story's not being told. The stats, I'm not sure where they're getting all the data, because, you know, in my small little world, I'm seeing things that are quite different. I do think we have inflation still in housing in certain parts of the country. I still think you call it price stability, but there's such elevated levels, and I do think we still have it in the stock market. I do, especially in the tech names. So you can say that inflation has come back in picture, is a little bit, it's improving, things are stabilizing, and they probably are in a small way. But it seems that when you look at these numbers, it gets very confusing as to how representative they are of what's going on.
We got DCG here. We got Dan Chief Greg. If we came up with the DCG number, inflation number, where we don't let anybody see any of the detail, we don't have any idea where it comes from, and say it's 1%, would anybody believe us? This PC number is useless. There isn't anybody that has
any... You guys just figured that one out?
Well, no, I'm saying, what's the point? They could say it's minus 5. Does that make it true?
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying, and I agree with you guys. I mean, Greg, what's going on with food prices in general right now?
Well, they're going down now.
They are going down finally. Okay, so that is finally starting to happen, which is good. But there's still... Yeah, I mean, I think that where they gather the statistics for inflation... still somewhat confusing.
Well, the CPI, you can see right where they're lying there.
Yes.
And it's in housing and it's in hospitalization.
Exactly. Medical expenses. Yeah. Insurance expenses have gone up. And they were talking yesterday about, services being housing and non-housing services coming down. I don't know if those prices are necessarily coming down. If anybody knows, I have a lot of clients that are contractors or in that industry. I don't know that the prices are necessarily coming down. They may be stabilizing, but again, how they're collecting the data and reporting it, I don't totally trust.
I just, as you know, Dan, I'm a non-repentant monetarist, and I listen to the, and there's a lot of stuff that's always, standard fare. Okay, because in normal times, whatever the hell normal means, if you have a business cycle, recession, or growth, that you and I and the world is fairly, we're okay with, all right? That just happens. Everything is on somewhat of a cycle where, not that you can time all that much, but all of a sudden business is good, people expand a little too much, blah, 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 and all of a sudden there's a little bit of a, well, you didn't really need the fifth hot dog stand, and you cut one back or you do something. And you'll see people get laid off, or people get, when it's really going good, everybody's working overtime. You see this sort of business cycle thing that sort of corrects itself, okay? I mean, and generally, it's not good when you're on the downside of that, but it's not horrible. I mean, people might get laid off for a couple of months, but they don't lose their savings. It's not like the Great Depression where the bank shut down and you don't have any money. It's not like 2007 where you saved up your whole life for 50 grand to put down in a house, and all of a sudden the 50 grand was gone. Those are like balance sheet things, which really have happened a couple times. And and would happen again, by the way, if the market ever cracked, which I hope it doesn't. But what this happened, for these guys to come out and, really for a very learned guy like you, I don't think any of what you said is absolutely true 99% of the time. I just think this, what they've done is so out there. We didn't. They blew inflation up at a time when nobody was working, because they put so much money in the system. Now to come out there and say this is standard 1950s fare, that before we can pull some money out of the system, or we need people to be laid off to stop the inflation. No, this inflation is purely a monetary event. It has nothing to do with people working or not working.
Right. It's too much money being pumped into the system, and it has been for a number of years, quite a few years.
I did this calculation. We haven't talked to you since last Thursday, and you're going to get this number exactly correct, I'm sure. What do you suppose, since 2000 until today, the average money supply growth has been?
I couldn't even guess.
Well, what do you think the average real growth has been?
All right, let's work through this. What are we estimating?
We're talking, what is the money supply growth per year?
What is the money supply growth
per year for 24 years since 2000?
Since 2000? Well, I'm going to guess it's be below the S&P's rate of gain and above whatever the CPI says. So,
money supply growth has been 7.3% for 24 years.
Yeah, that was what I seven was where.
Now, if you think that real growth has been 2.5, which is probably where it's been,
yeah,
you're talking about a 4.5 to 5% inflation every year for 24 years, which is exactly what we've had. Hospitalization, houses, you name it. And the idea that they didn't create that, the idea that the stocks are up so much because of that. It's not.
Well, the spiders were what, 140?
Something like that, yeah.
So 140, and now they're 530?
550.
550.
That's a number.
Yeah.
Now, are the spiders up or is the dollar down?
Both.
Yeah.
Both can happen at the same time.
Both can happen at the same time. So, I mean, the idea that they've got to wait for people to get laid off. And these labor numbers, Dan, you're right.
No, I'm wrong. Against the euro, it's not even close. The dollar is... The dollar rallied.
Well, but the euro did the same thing. And so did the... That's the point. They've all done it together. It's a wealth bubble thing, and but it's not. If this happened in 19 whatever, you would have seen the dollar getting collapsed because we keep putting dollars in the system when the French and the Swiss and everybody else aren't. But they're all doing it too. It's very coordinated.
The relationships are. There's no question.
Yeah. But Dan, you were saying, like, when you look at the labor numbers, you and I could go through it, and if they were to say, hey, we're going to give you two Jamokes, $100,000 to come out to this seminar, and you're going to plead the case that labor is doing great. You and I could knock the stage off with them, right? By only looking at half the facts. Or right. They could say, hey, you two Jamokes, come out here and say how horrible it's happening for labor. You know what? We could do that too. Right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it was interesting to go to the next level with what you're saying. There was some questions yesterday at the press conference after Powell spoke regarding any type of political, influence on the way this is being reported, not necessarily on the numbers, but maybe on the numbers themselves and the way it's being reported. And Powell quickly, you know, got very defensive when that question came up, but there has to be some political motivation in an election year. There's no question about it. It's kind of human nature that there would be. So that I think that there is a certain amount of or that and or the fact that they're trying to make themselves look good and that they're doing the right thing. So maybe it's a combination of both, right?
Next time you come to Chicago, I will bet you the most expensive adult beverage over at Ceres that the person who asked that question will never be asked back.
Right, I agree. Oh yeah.
What? Where did that one come from? And
yeah, but I think it's an important question.
Sure it is. But you're not supposed to ask it.
You get the big picture, and then to also you have to question where the numbers come from. You have to question the information that's being given to you because it can be massaged or adjusted to suit whoever's making those calls. You know, that's just part of what's happened in the markets for the last 40 years that I've been in it. And that's what companies often do, or people that are analysts that are making their recommendations will tend to focus on certain things without giving you the full picture. So,
well, do you think for a second that Jerome Powell wants Trump anywhere near him again after last time?
Absolutely.
No, I mean, I don't think he wants him anywhere near him.
Right. And I'm agreeing with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't.
So, Dan, I'm going to ask you a question here about the labor numbers. And this is not, I'm not trying to be argumentative at all here. I'm just saying this is how conflicting this stuff is. When I said you and I could win the prize for both sides of the argument, we could. I mean, if you look at the labor stuff, it looks good. You know, we're up to 4.1% in unemployment instead of 3.6 a year ago. 4.1 is not horrible, right? I mean, it's not traditionally. But if you look at every month, they're touting is 250, 225, 275,000 people hired every month, right? Now, it's been that, like, at least for the last year and longer than that, correct? I mean, that's been the number. So you add that together or you multiply it out, 250 times 12 is what? 3 million people, correct?
Yeah.
And yet, but now the establishment survey takes everybody who's working. If somebody calls Dan Janitas Inc., and you say, I got five people working, last month I had four, they add a guy, or later, whatever, they add a person. And that's fine. But now, they don't ask you, is there any of those people working anywhere else? So people could be getting counted two or three times, right?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And there are plenty of people who have multiple positions, right, so especially if looking at people who are struggling or have, you know, that are maybe lower income that are having to do that just to pay for housing and living expenses.
Okay, cool. So last year, and I'm looking at the household survey, which means you call Dan's home and you ask the WIF or whoever or who's ever there, by the way, how many people you got? How many people in your house are employed? And she's going to say one, Dan. She's not going to say Dan is managing money during the delay. He's delivering pizzas on Friday night. And oh, by the way, he's doing people's taxes on Saturday. She's not going to say that. The answer is one. Right. So we just said, according to the survey that you hear on TV all the time, that is 3 million people. Yet I'm looking at the household survey, June of 2023, 161 million people, 004 employed. And now 161,199. So in the total increase for the year is 199,000 people, 195,000 people. It's a lot different than 3 million.
And I do think part of that's coming from people who are having to work Correct. Two jobs. And you're right, they're only reporting one or they're reporting them twice.
Right. So
depending on how the survey, if it's household, they're only reporting them once. So I absolutely agree.
But it gives you a whole different view.
And that's also part of the issue with inflation, too. Part of the problem because again, you know, we tend to talk about the market and we focus on, you know, the people who've acquired wealth, whether it be through their 401ks or through their housing, but there's a large part of the population that's still, you know, working two jobs to pay rent and food. And so you're right, and those jobs would not be counted. One other thing I want to mention about the employment picture, that, and this is going back to pre-pandemic, what I was saying back then in terms of looking at inflation is that the one thing that hadn't happened yet was increases in wages. And that's why I think there wasn't as much concern about runaway inflation 6 years ago, let's say, 5 years ago. So now, you know, wages are still increasing, and part of that is to still attract talent. Wages absolutely were going up over the last 5 years. Because of the demand, the need, the lack of supply, and now they're starting to moderate, according to them. But I want to see a few more specifics about how they're moderating. And I think wage increases, you know, are a big part of the inflation picture as well.
Well, I think they are, and not again. It's not the ones that these guys look at.
Right.
I mean, they're going to look at the union wages.
Right.
The union contracts that are here in the, I mean, when you look at the auto workers, got this incredible, you know, 25% raise over 5 years. Of course, they didn't have a contract for 2 years, which really means 7 years. Anybody who thinks that if you got a 25% raise, it totals up in, where are we, 2024, it totals up in 2027 versus 2020. If you think you're ahead of the game at 25% up, I mean, your math is really bad, I think. But I'm going to say that the people who do work around your house are the people who didn't do anything for 3 years because of COVID, and now, like, everybody's catching up on their air conditioner that needs to be replaced, their furnace, all those kinds of things. They're in gouge stage. They've made it to the point where they're not making $500-$600 a day, and they're not coming over, you know, which is real dull. I mean, we're not talking about, I mean, it's a skilled profession, but there's... I mean, one of my clients is in the sprinkler system. You know, they put in commercial sprinkler systems. I think they're up to $800 a day per person, or more, or more than that. I mean, there's been massive inflation in that kind of stuff. I mean, in the building
down
there.
You know what other field chief are lawyers?
Because I have
friends who are lawyers that I'm just blown away by their hourly rates.
$600-$700 an hour. I mean. Really?
Oh, even higher than that.
Yeah,
even higher than that. You know, 1,000 or higher. It's nuts. In the big cities, you know, in Boston, New York, LA, or the expensive cities, let's put it that way. And it just blows me away. And, you know, it's funny because I would look at them with a straight face and said, I would kill them making that kind of money.
Well, I would love to actually be able to stop the world for like a month.
Yeah.
You know, just hold it. And have the people who do the show with us, you and the professors and Lou, sit down and write a series of about 10 position papers, which we'd all be probably all be bloody from fighting, but by the end of the day, there'd be 10 really serious position papers where we could talk about a lot of this stuff that is a you know, a bifurcation in this society. Remember, there was a guy, he's got to be dead, but maybe not. He used to keep track of the price of high-price hookers versus low-price hookers. For, you know, regular people's hookers.
And yeah.
And for a period of time, he talked about how the high price...
Said, said research.
Was that...
How did he conduct his research?
I don't know.
Did he need any...
He probably
does he sponsor volunteers?
I think he probably talked to some people he knew frequented the people and asked what the number was. I don't know. But, I mean, but essentially got to the point where the streetwalkers were going down and the ones that meet you in the, you know, in the Trump Plaza were going up. And, but I would say that that's... That
isn't there a stripper index?
Probably.
But, there should be.
But now, you can proxy that now. But strippers have gone down, but OnlyFans, yeah, you could use that as a proxy for...
Yeah, there you go. That's, well, yeah, that's
Greg, perfect. You and I know when Dan talks about the attorneys...
I don't know it, personally.
Well, you know, I'm kind of switching subject here about the attorney issue. We know people that have regular... Like I said, they deal with regular criminals, regular small lawsuits, regular those kinds of things. Their prices, if anything, Dan, I think have gone down because people don't have the
Job. And that I would agree with. There are people who, because I have family members who do that, and they are struggling in the being able to collect money because their market, their client base is generally there are people who are struggling financially.
And the reason why they're suing somebody
has been that bifurcation. I wanted to ask Greg a question about does Illinois or Chicago itself have a minimum wage for servers?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Greg knows all about that. Greg, explain that.
Well,
there was a tip credit, and, you know, the restaurant is guaranteeing all the way up to the minimum wage. And if, say, they didn't make a certain amount in tips to get them to the minimum wage, well, the restaurant would have to pick up the slack. And now what's happened is they've decided to give the servers the full minimum wage in addition to their tips. So what happens is there's going to be a bigger divide between, say, the dishwasher and the busboy and the server still, because whereas before the server was probably they would use the tip credit and we would pay however many, call it, you know, $8 or $10 an hour for them, and then they would more than make up for especially the minimum wage. The lawmakers decided to give the servers now full minimum wage, and so their income is going to go up because, you know, they're still working their shift and they're going to get the full minimum wage, and they didn't do anything for the people who actually only make the minimum wage. So it's a weird dynamic. We had written to a few aldermen to say, you know, this is what you're doing, kind of, you know, we'd like to make it so that the kitchen and the bussers make more because the servers are doing okay. And
they're the highest people in your place, and they're the ones they're worried about.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that happens, but the kitchen staff kind of got left behind on this one because they're the ones really making the lower because they don't even have the opportunity for those tips. Sometimes the serving staff or the bartenders will throw money towards that, but, you know, they're not required to do any of that. And in the restaurant, you know, you can't. Well, we've done some stuff, but you try to make it more even, and then this happens, and you go, oh, this is not going to go over well.
Yeah, because there's ramifications to that, and I'm thinking California, too, where they have, is it $20 minimum for service?
Yeah, well, they just decided to throw in the towel. A lot of those shops just closed up and said, we don't even want to deal. It's not worth the extra effort.
Yeah.
So you'll get more automation.
It affects the small business owner. I mean, there's a trickle-down effect. It affects prices because you have to be able to stay competitive, stay in business. So it's, you know, there are other problems. I mean, I'm kind of old school when it comes to servers, you know, whether it be somebody waiting on your table or bartenders, because I bartended through college and grad school, that, you know, you work a little harder, you get a little more, you know, in general. And there's, you know, there's an incentive to the workers to work, you know, to work a little harder, to give them some sort of bonus or benefit to that. And, you know, that shouldn't be taken away.
Yeah, and in the old Illinois, and you know, I don't know, it's probably a nasty statement. I'm not in a grumpy mood here today, but I'm gonna say it's full force on giving other people's money away to the people you think are gonna vote for you. I mean, there's something, and there's no capability in any of this mayoral staff of any place that I've seen of actually sitting down and say, okay, if this is what we do, what's the world gonna look like in 2 years from now because of this? They can't do it, and they don't want to do it. What's the one?
Yeah, I think that's. I agree with you on that. That there's not. They're not looking at the whole picture. They're not looking at the ramifications of some of these decisions. They're just making these decisions, you know, without looking at the potential consequences.
Greg, what's the story on the? I read part of that new law, and you know, obviously you're the expert on the part that affecting the wait staff and so forth. But what's the BS about the time off? It's absolutely.
Oh, for a certain amount of hours worked, you have to have time off, and they might have changed the break once. I would need to check. You know, my cousin does that stuff.
I think if you work 10 days in a quarter, you get a week off. It's some bizarre.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll check. I'll check today.
Yeah, because there's a. You know, I read this, Dan, and the next day I go, it can't be right. What I remembered, I read it again. Now I don't want to lob it out there, but I don't. But it's
what we're doing now is we're keeping track of hours worked per week, and that's how we're doing days off now. So,
but I think if somebody comes in and works like 1 week, you got to give them time off at the quarter, and it's bizarre. Anyway, let's look it up. We'll talk about it next week. But
I guess going back, Chief, to your sort of picture about employment and not seeing everything, and I just use this as an example that this is an example. I think that isn't necessarily being put into the numbers or being certainly discussed. It's not, you know, and it is part of the equation. It's definitely part of, I mean, that's just one example of the employment picture that's part of the equation that may not be, where there may not be focus and there needs to be.
Well, I don't think that's the combination. I mean, you know, I go back to the one line. Inflation is every time and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. It has nothing to do with people working or not working.
I mean, right, but it does have to do with being forced to increase wages.
Right.
Which is what I'm getting at. That's where I'm talking about the inflation.
Yeah.
And I do think wage increases really are an important part of the overall inflation picture.
But then it again, it's amazingly uneven. And that's why you have to be
it
so
is.
Careful.
Yes.
Because some
precisely.
People, I'm going to say that the one air conditioner repairman in your vicinity, he can raise them tomorrow. If you're if you're a schlump working at a McDonald's, you don't have any power at all.
Right.
Somebody, one of the listeners sent me a, I think it was one of the listeners, sent me a W-2 of somebody. I didn't, the name was blacked out. And somebody worked a full year at McDonald's in one of these states where the minimum wage is $7.25 or $7.50. The person's year for a 40-hour week, I mean, I don't know, it was 40, but it was full-time, the guy's or lady's salary last year was $13.5.
Wow.
What exactly do you do with that?
That's not right. there's something definitely not right about that. I'm agreeing that it's, I'm not saying necessarily that it's, you know, I'm agreeing that it's okay to increase wages. I'm just saying that there's ramifications from it.
Well, sure.
You know, not that they shouldn't, but there will be some, and that's something that isn't necessarily being discussed. I think that's all really geographic. I really do think it depends on where you are.
Were you in college? Did you ever have to sit boringly through a course in labor economics?
Yes. Grad school, yeah.
You sweated your way through that one?
Yeah.
I'm going to say, Dan, except in very small cases, none of what I learned applies in the economy we have today.
That's very true. Very little does. Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you. I think the some of the liberal arts education of the math, you know, math major as an undergrad, is, in terms of how you think, learning logic and all that, has been much more helpful than some of the case studies, you know, that really don't apply to today that I learned in business school.
Well, but the Greg, I don't know if you ever did it or the listeners, but it's an economic model like all economic models, and I think we've managed to screw up half the models by the definitions are different. I mean, obviously the labor economics doesn't work in a slave state. Duh.
Right.
I mean, so but the idea is that the you hire people, and if you hire the first person you hire, if you got this mechanism, you got this product, first person you hire, you're paying him $10 an hour, and he's making $100 an hour for you. All right. So the second person you hire, he's probably not going to make as much as the first person. He's going to make 90 for you. And what you do is you end up employing people to the last person. Basically, you don't make any from the guy. You got 99 people in the place, and you had one more, and so you're. With the marginal, what's the term? The marginal something something equals the marginal return,
right?
And but now, you don't see that at all. I mean, you see, and like even in a restaurant, I'm not talking about a McDonald's, but this Thai place that Audrey and I go, the cook leaves. This is during COVID. The cook leaves, and no, of course, you know they don't gouge you on the chow at all, and you bring your own wine. Matter of fact, it's a very wallet friendly evening, and it's really good food. But, you know, they go from, say, $14 from a dinner, which is pretty cheap, up to, like, $17.50 or $18, which is still, and now it's, you know, $20, but $21. It's still, you know, in today's world, it's not bad, especially if you bring your own wine, that kind of thing. And so the cook leaves because he's not getting paid enough. Well, now the prices are already up, right? So the owner's wife's, or the owner's husband is telling me, yeah, well, this guy wanted... like, you know, I just gave him a raise from like $12.50 to $16. And I'm sitting there on the tip of my tongue, I bit my lip. I was going to say, wait a minute, how many dinners does the guy make an hour?
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure the answer, you know, the guy's there all day and they do lunch and stuff. I'm going to say the answer's 20, you know, whatever.
Yep.
Probably when it's busy, probably does 40. Okay, you just raise the prices. For that hour, you're making now $125 more than you did 2 weeks ago, and you're throwing a guy a $4 bone. I mean, you're not even on the same planet.
Yeah, I go back to our way of analyzing companies and looking at management, and looking at how management treats employees, and you know, you reward the good employees. You reward them with increases, and if a good employee, a consistent employee. Is asking for a little bit of a raise, you give it to them. I mean, there's a management style, I think, that, and you create an environment that where they want to work, you know,
right.
You create an environment where they're rewarded for their good work, and, you know, where there's, there is definitely, I go to management, and I think management really is the key to any type of business being successful.
But it also is, you look at what the person's doing for you. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, if you and I, just because we're the knuckleheads we are, if we went to the Walmart and they stuck us in the tire area and we're making whatever you make in Walmart, $20 an hour, which is fine. Okay, we need a job. I wouldn't guarantee, Dan, especially we have Greg, because everybody likes Greg. Not sure why. I'm going to guess the three of us are going to, in 6 months, we're going to double the tire sales in that place. Just because sure. The way we are. Now, does that mean... we still make $20 an hour? Or does Walmart have the freedom to say, hey, you three idiots are worth 50? I don't think they do.
They should have the freedom to do that.
I don't think they do.
That's the thing. They should be making those decisions and recognizing that. We had years and years ago, at one of the organizations where I worked, investment management organization, we had a woman who basically was doing the job of two people. She wasn't getting paid more. She was a really hard worker. Actually, got her math major at undergrad at Notre Dame. So she was smart. She was good. She had a great personality.
She was a math major.
She got things done.
She's a math major. What? She had a good personality. How'd that happen?
A few of us. But the point about what happened is when she had an injury. She was running and she fell and she actually hurt herself. So she was out. They had to hire two new people to replace her. So there's, you know, there's a certain amount of you know, you need that recognition, and you need that, you know, you need to look at, as you're saying, you need to look at the work, and but you also have to be able to motivate them. You have to provide good incentives, and
why do we know
that as business owners, but it's that I think is what can fail a lot of businesses, and that's why we do that extra work in terms of meeting the management of the companies we invest in and kicking the tires with them and really getting to know them, because they're the decisions they make are going to be the decisions that not only help the company but also help the price of their stock or their bonds.
Well, Dan, why is there such a, I don't want to use the term again, a split in people's somewhat mentality in how they view what they do versus something else? I mean, somebody, you look at somebody like you and you say, I'm not committing my money or somebody else's money that I care about, meaning a client, whether it's a defined fiduciary or not, I'm not going to put money in this firm unless I know who these guys are. And yet...
That's you.
And you know, other people are sitting there willing to pour money into NVIDIA because Morgan Stanley said buy it. How do you know Morgan Stanley's not the one selling it to you?
Right. They definitely have an axe to grind.
I don't get that.
In the business, you got to consider the source of where you're getting the recommendation. Being a buy side portfolio manager my whole career, that's something that I'm very, you know, acute. And we make our own decisions when we're looking at companies. We listen. We read analyst reports and we listen to the street on their recommendations. But we really end up making our own decisions, and they're not always consistent with the street recommendations.
Well, people's view of other people working. There was a. You would never have come with me, Dan, because I know you don't go to bars. there was this bar in South Bend that had fish fry on Friday, and plus they had a great pool table. And so we used to go there once in a while on Friday nights. And on the wall was a poster that said, "Just remember, everybody else in the world but you is overpaid."
Yeah.
So, when people see a company lay off people, there are regular workers in this world. They actually think, well, that's a good thing because my price, whatever I buy from these people, is going down. No, it's not. What you ought to think is, I no matter how bloated a company is, and there are a few that, you know, get pretty bloated, I suppose, nobody goes to work for 8 hours and does nothing, I don't think, unless you're either male or female, the best looking person on earth, and all you do is walk around and everybody looks at you or something. But maybe that happens someplace, but it's not going to happen to you or me. But every time a firm that has 1,000 people lays off 100 people, somebody's picking up what they used to do, which means they actually have their wages lowered, really, right? You and I would think.
Yeah, that was my point about this woman, there's no question that's happening. But I want, if I can ask to switch gears a little,
sure,
I want to make
please,
sure I
please do.
A little.
Yeah, please do.
Mention a little bit about what's currently going on, you know, with bonds and you know, people be, you know, listeners being wondering, you know, still where to put their money, because we've talked a lot about T-bills. I still think they're a good investment. I would say 1 to 2 month T-bills, 1 to 2.5 month.
Are they still over 5?
2.5 month would mean you buy it in the secondary market, but you're still getting 5.40.
There's a big drop this morning in them, wasn't there? Let me look.
This morning, in general, they've come down because I think there's, you know, with the Fed speech, he's really leaning, you know, largely leaning to a cut in September. So I think that's getting priced into the market. But the short-est T-bills, not the 6 month, the short-est ones, as of yesterday, we were buying them at 5.40. Now, we're buying off the run. We're not buying the current T-bills.
The three-month is 5.27. I think we went last week and got like 5.4.
But look at the 1 month.
Okay, you know, this is the lowest that goes on this is Bloomberg.
It's the 1 month and the 2 month that are higher, and that's just because of where the Fed funds rate is right now at 5.25 to 5.5. So what I'm basically saying is you got to shift down in maturity. You got to shift from the 3 month or the 6 month down to the 1 or 2 month to get that extra yield. And yes, it will continue to come down, but you can get that incremental return if you stay short. And that has shifted. You're absolutely right. That has shifted over the last few weeks.
Dan, what do you make of, now that you've got me to this page, it always brings up a question that maybe only you can answer. This is, you know, we've got this sloping yield curve which is weird. It's been like this for a long time, where there's this downward sloping yield curve. But look at it, this is how weird. 3 months is 5.27, 6, 5.08, 12, 4.73, 2 year, 4.25. Now get a load of this one. 5 year, 3.9, and then the 10 year goes back up again, 4.03, 4.31. Why would somebody give any money 5 years for 3.9 to anybody?
Right, and that's why we do what we do in terms of, you know, we look at the yield curve and we look at the best value and you look at the optimum yield you're getting, and if you're looking for income, that's one way to do it. You have to look at the yield curve very carefully, and it does change every day. So there's an art and a science to it as a money manager when you're looking at that. But the other areas, you know, certainly as you mentioned, long rates coming down. Corporate bonds, I still think, and high yield bonds, I think the spreads are too tight. I think corporate bonds are expensive, with some exceptions, so you can still find some value. Municipal bonds still look really good, and especially if you're in a high tax state. You can get, you know, a 7% or 7.5% tax equivalent yield with in those states where you're going to get both the federal and the state, and in some cases the local.
Dan, do you have to be? You have to buy. If you're, let's say, you're in California, which is a high tax state, do you have to buy a California bond to not have a tax to California? Can you buy an Illinois bond?
You cannot buy. You would get the federal tax break if you bought an Illinois bond and you lived in California.
But you don't get the state.
You don't get the state, but so with the state, it would either have to be a state issued bond. So for example, if you're in California, it would have to be a California issued bond, but there are some exceptions. So there's a few places that you can invest that are covered, that are triple tax exempt. So one of those is Puerto Rico. The other is the U.S. Virgin Islands. And the other is Guam.
Why is it?
So they're that because they're territories, that's just the way they've been given that triple tax exemption, meaning state, local, and federal. So there are bonds, for example, for Virgin Islands, for like say an airport bond. Guam has airport bonds, and you can get them right now at probably, you know, you can get one maybe at 6% before the tax break, so that would be a tax equivalent yield of close to 8%, depending on the state you live in. So I think a clever way of investing, and also diversification away from your state. So depending on where you think your state is going. But I will say the other thing about munis is the default rate historically is much lower than say on corporate bonds. So there's that other benefit. Most municipal bonds that go into default, the workouts end up paying them close to 90% you get 90% of the recovery, whereas it's lower on corporate bonds.
Dan, what's the isn't the Guam the place that's overrun by snakes?
Guam?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't mind snakes.
Oh, no, they're all over there. They have to check planes coming from there to see if they're in the wheel.
Oh, right. Yeah,
what is that. When you say the default rate? Now, just out of the blue, I'll pick a city. Pick Peoria, for instance. I mean, I don't know why I think about Peoria, because of Caterpillar. I'm watching Caterpillar stock move here. Pick Peoria. Now, if you want, do you want a general obligation? When you say default rates, for a general obligation bond, for that to go sour, Peoria pretty much has to declare bankruptcy, right? Now, what about if you buy I know this is getting technical, but if you're going to buy these bonds, listeners, you know, you got to know what you're buying. What if I buy the Peoria Sanitary District bond that's paid for separately on the tax thing? They're a separate taxing authority. If they have trouble, if the thing blows up or something, now Peoria, they don't have to bail those guys out, right? I mean, they could just. Which is better, or does it depend on the case?
It's different in every case. So there are different types of bonds that are issued. So there are general obligation bonds, and they could be for Peoria, but they could also be for a particular district. School district, for example, is an example of where, you know, if the school district was failing, the public school district, that is, in say Peoria, then the city would be responsible for that.
Okay.
That would be but there is also bonds called industrial IDRs, and and they are they can be corporate, so they can be think of them as corporate bonds. So if there was a new building for you know I don't know the a new development there, and they were able to get municipal financing, but it was a it you know it was backed by a company. You have to look at the rating of that company. So if it was, I can't think of an example, a new tech company, let's say, that's building a location, a warehouse there or something. So if they're able, it is possible to get municipal financing, but if something were to happen to that bond or that company or that facility, it would be the company's obligation and not the city of Peoria.
So what if in Chicago there's got to be 12, 15 different taxing on there? And like you're right, the schools are just, they just let you know what that is. But if it's the, you know, the Metropolitan Sanitary District, it's going to be, there's going to be a thing on there for water treatment, or if it's for just plain water bill, you know, there's going to be, you're going to have, the water bill is probably separate, but still, now if somebody goes out for a redo of the filtration plant, say, that's going to be paid for by that tax and not the city directly, correct?
That would be the first, right? So the first obligation would be to the, you know, the first source of revenue, if you will, would be the taxes that are paid specifically to that utility. But then, depending on the way the indenture is on the bond, and this is what we do, is we look and we read to see where the risks are and who could bail them out. It may be the city and it may be the state. It may be the county, depending on which state you live in.
Because it might be nobody, right?
No, generally there is going to be, and that's what I'm saying with municipals, generally there is a, there are backers, if you will. There, you know, there's a list of who is, you know, obligated first, just as there would be, you know, with any type of creditor situation. So in some, let's say, for example, in Florida, it's done by county. So the county water, Charlotte County, Florida, the bill that I would receive from the water company comes from them. And yes, they would be the ones, if they issued municipal debt, they would be the ones that would be ultimately responsible. But in this case, the state would be responsible behind them.
Okay.
So the state doesn't have to necessarily, but if the particular issue of the bond says that they're, you know, we have to look at the backing. So in some cases, there could be a bond that's written like that. The other thing about municipal bonds is you have something called a sinking fund. And a sinking fund is where the, let's say, the utility company has to put a certain amount of money aside during, say, the 10 years of that the bond is outstanding before it matures. And then that, so that gives you protection. Used to be insurance on municipal bonds would give you protection as well. So you might have to pay a little more for those bonds, but you'd have that backing. And then finally, if it's a situation that goes into default, there are usually, depending on what the specific issue is, and depending on how the indenture is written, there are usually going to be people that would bail out a required or essential service, you know, like water, for example. So there's going to be backing at some level for those, and that's why those municipalities have a much lower default rate than, say, it was, IBM opening a facility there, or not IBM, NVIDIA, or somebody opening a facility, or a semiconductor, another semiconductor company looking for a U.S. Presence.
Well, it's funny, Dan, I would bet that a lot of listeners, and we're getting a little technical here, but by the way, if that's why you need somebody like Dan to get the bonds for you, for God's sake.
Absolutely.
And actually what Dan and I have done is, if one of the we have two clearing firms at PTI. We have World Bank of Canada, RBC, and their traditional kind of place. And then we also have Interactive Brokers for people who want to do online stuff and everything. It's a great online thing. But Interactive Brokers, both Dan and I, are registered there as investment advisors. So if somebody wanted to open up a PTI Pro Direct account, which uses the IB back system, you could open up an account, trade away to your heart's content on a system. And now, why would you use us and not Interactive? because Interactive won't answer the phone. You know, if you're somewhere and you can't look at the stock and you want to make a trade, you can call us. You can't call IBM. Well, you could call them, but I think it's like $75 a trade if they put them in for you. We're not going to do that to you. But also, if all of a sudden you say, gee, I like the idea of these interactive, I like the idea of putting some of my money in municipals or having Dan manage some of my stuff, the next day we can flip your stuff to Dan, yes. Which whatever deal you make with Dan, it's none of my business, and Dan can manage that. Or if you say, well, I still want to trade, but I also have these three stocks that I want to be protected or whatever, and I want you to manage those, we can shift that to my group. I think it's an absolutely perfect way for somebody who wants to do some stuff on their own but also needs help in some areas and can shift it back and forth if they want.
Absolutely. I would absolutely agree with you on that. And that's the way I've managed money for a number of my clients, where they may have an account at Interactive where they're trading tech stocks, because that's not necessarily our specialty, but we would be managing the bonds or the income portion of what they have, or a balanced account for them, using our strategy and our research. And I always recommend to people, if they're not sure, just to peel off a piece of their account, and that can be done as well.
Well, plus Dan, the
strategy. I think it's a good balance to have.
It is.
Have some protection through your protected strategy, to have some fixed income, and then to still have a small amount in equities as well, or to have an allocation of equities. Again, it all depends on your level of risk tolerance and your where you are right now in your time horizon in terms of retirement and what wanting to be able to retain what you've worked hard for all these years.
Well, Dan, I think people understand that in some level, I have an ego that I'm going to try and do the best I can for people, okay? But just by me answering Danny's questions, if somebody calls up and says, I got this, pick a number, $3 million account, and I've decided I'm going to put $1.5 million in fixed income, first thing I'm going to say is, you need Dan, not me. I have some idea, but that's not what I do. But if somebody says, we have people here with bonds and stuff, and we have all kinds of people with bonds, but it's not the focus. We're spending our time finding the right stuff. That's what Dan does. You know, we've also, you say, gee, not only is this Invinia, I was smart enough to buy, 10,000 shares or 500 shares when the thing was $100. And by the way, it split all these different times. Now, like 90% of my account is in Invinia, and I'm kind of worried about it here and want to protect it. Well, that's what we do better than anybody else.
Absolutely.
And you might want to sit there and trade S&Ps all day long on your own, but I'll take care of the Nvidia concentration issue. I mean, whatever it is, I think people need to be, because right now, Dan, I can't tell you when want to, and I don't think either can Greg, whether we're going up or we're going down. But this kind of intraday volatility, this is not healthy. It is not healthy, I don't think.
Yeah, and we've talked about the fact that there's still issues that have been sort of put to the back burner, like the federal deficit, that are going to creep up on us. And this is an election year, so this is going to continue to we're going to continue to see probably some strength in the financial markets. But just as we had when COVID hit, these exogenous events, and exogenous means something that comes from the outside that nobody is thinking about. It could be a war. It could be It could be what we had a few weeks ago with the internet outage with the airlines and all of that caused chaos. I'm surprised that the markets didn't sell off more
than
that.
Could be somebody
they would have if it had been continued, right?
Well, yeah, we got a dash, Dan, but it could be simple like somebody not showing up for an auction.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Duh.
Great. Well, I'll be there on the 29th.
That'll be cool.
August.
All right, but and we'll have a. We'll figure out who owes who on drinks by then.
It's my birthday, so I guess
we gotta buy Greg birthday drink. There you go. SP Futures up 29.
So we'll have a joint celebration.
And as SP Futures up 90, you guys can do the cigars. I'm out on the cigars, but you guys can you can have one for me. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.